Welcome everybody here tonight. For the benefit of the tape, I'm going to read this. Some of you may have heard it last week, so he gets it. Well, let you know who Reverend Eldridge is. The Reverend Elton Eldridge holds an A.B. degree from Dartmouth and a B.B. from the Episcopal Theological School. He has served as Rector of Churches in Alaska and New Hampshire, as Executive Secretary for College Work, Province of New England, and Executive Secretary Leadership Training Division of the National Council Protestant Episcopal Church. He has also served on the summer faculties of Leadership Training Institutes at various colleges in the Northeast. Since 1958, Reverend Eldridge has been the director of the Educational Center of St. Louis. Tonight he's going to give us a presentation, Introduction to Carl G. Jung, Basic Concepts. Reverend Eldridge?
Thank you, Paul.
First of all, I think I should say that I am not a psychologist, I am not a psychiatrist, I am not an analyst. I am, as Paul has identified, a clergyman who's been doing a variety of things through the last many years. And when I was in college, I did go so far as to take a course in psychology, and I learned about the Freud and the sex drive and Adler and the power drive, and the third man's name is Jung, the third of the so-called big three. what Jung was talking about was never mentioned. That was in 1934, I think. It was only about 15 years ago, through a set of somewhat accidental circumstances, and we began to discover, up at the Education Center here, that Carl Jung, while he was not the great innovator in one way, he was not the great pioneer that Freud had been, was a tremendous person in his own right, and through the sex drive and the power drive, which he did not disagree with Freud or Adler, except in their emphasis upon them. He said there's a third major drive, which is the drive toward for meaning and wholeness. And increasingly, through the last 15 years, we have found his work and the work of his whole school to be of more and more use to us in our work in religious education. So what we're going to do tonight is try to give you a very brief identification of Dr. Jung's identification of the psyche. It's a pretty complicated thing, as he always admitted. There's nothing more mysterious in the whole universe, as far as he was concerned, than the unconscious. And he set out in his early work as a psychiatrist to explore this very mysterious realm. I should rather suspect that when the definitive book is written on the 20th century, there will be certainly an important chapter on the exploration of outer space, but I suspect that 20 more chapters will be given to the exploration of inner space, because I think the elements which we will touch upon tonight have so much more depth of meaning for mankind than moon rocks. I think that's probably about right now. But this is my own view at the moment. Jung himself, as those of you who saw the movie last week, didn't base his theories on sitting up in an ivory tower thinking up how things might be, but on he based the development of his thinking on his work with analysons, his work in the consulting room, and as the picture identified, working through and trying to discover the meaning of 67,000 dreams. That's a lot of dreams. And he kept finding certain common elements in dreams of people from all over the world, because he was working with people from all over the world, that he began to identify certain forces and factors for which he began to try to find some way to describe. And he picked some rather strange terms, and he would never have advertised any of them as terms, but he had to find some sort of language, some sort of new language to try to identify factors and forces in the psyche of men and women that needed some sort of definition, even though in many ways they remain forever mysterious. Jung was an amazing guy. He never stopped. He worked at this business right up until the age of 83, 84, when he died in 1961. He was always willing to go back and revise. He was always extremely willing to have his followers, his students, build on what he had done. He was a pioneer. He recognized in particular areas he was very much a brand new pioneer, and he never advertised anything that he said. And he very much encouraged, those of his followers to build on and go beyond where he was. This was one area where he differed radically from Freud, because, as again, somewhere as I said in the movie, once Freud had said something, that was the end of it. And he didn't want anybody deviating from pure Freud. This was his big battle originally with Adler, who had been his pupil. It became also a source of a very major break with Jung, who had never been his pupil but had been his friend, had traveled with him, had worked with him, had analyzed each other's dreams and so forth and so on. But Jung went a couple of steps in the early days beyond Freud, and by 1912 their friendship ended, which was a sad thing for both of them. We're going to try to do it here. Jung himself was often annoyed at his own followers, pupils, who he would hear. He would say something, say in 1915 and 1920. He would have developed that further, but he would hear one of his followers pounding the table and advertising something which he had said earlier. And his final response to this was, "Thank God I'm young and not a young man." And he refused to let his name be applied to his school. The school technically is known as the School of Analytical Psychology, even though it is still called Jungian psychology in a more popular vein. I did try to rush through two basic areas tonight, and then discuss any of them if you want to, and you can raise any kind of questions you want to. And if I don't know the answer, I'll say I don't know the answer, because I'm not an analyst. I'm merely a guy who got caught with him about 15 years ago, and he'd done a lot of reading and used a lot of his material in the various kinds of things we were doing at the center. The first thing I want to do is that of trying to identify the nature of a man's psyche, as Jung identified it, in terms of the various basic concepts. And the second thing I want to do when I finish that is to talk about his whole theory of psychological types, which, again, is an extremely important area in which he did the most important work that's been ever been done, as far as I know. Now, if one were able to take an x-ray of somebody's psyche, it would not look like this. But this is a picture of it. If any of you want to move up a little bit, I don't know if you can hide where this shows up. I will try to identify as we go, so that you don't have to be able to read it. This center circle represents what he calls the personal psyche. This is the stuff within my psychology, my psyche, which is mine because I have lived through it, I have experienced it. These are things which have come to me in whatever form, whatever way, during my own life. This, again, you'll notice that the circle has a line drawn down through the center. Just where that line should be is a question. This is a very arbitrary type of dividing it in the middle, and probably shouldn't be divided there. On the right-hand side, of the center line is what is known as the personal conscious. Now, you do not need to write this diagram down if you don't want to. I have many draft copies of it that you may have. This is the personal psyche. This is the stuff of which I can remember, get a hold of, things I can know, even though it means remembering back. But there are things I can get hold of with consciousness. The center of the personal conscious he identified as the ego. This is the center of consciousness. Then there is a layer outside of this right-hand side of the circle, which is, we call the persona, which of course is from the old word meaning mask. The persona is that which I reveal to the world, that of myself which I reveal to the world, the way I let myself come through. There are lots of things, I must confess, about myself which I'm not going to tell you about tonight. In fact, there are probably lots of things about myself I'll never tell anybody. I have a mask, and we all have masks. I think some of the mistakes being made in some of the work done these days in group dynamics and sensitivity training and encounter groups and so forth is that we keep the emphasis there seems to be strip off the mask, tear off everyone's mask, let's appear to each other as we really are. We couldn't really stand this. I was heard about an event over at Washington University. It took place about a year ago. A large group of about 60 people were in a conference. And toward the end of the conference, one girl, a black girl, identified the fact about 5 minutes before the conference ended that she was a lesbian. And this was a terrible thing to her. And everybody went home feeling utterly and totally depressed. That is what I would identify as intemperate and immoderate and quite inappropriate self-disclosure. This does not mean in terms of persona that we keep ourselves completely away from the world or from other people, but it does mean that there are certain things that are quite appropriate to identify and other things that are not appropriate. And 59 people went home from that conference feeling like hell. There was nothing, they had no further communication with her. She had opened herself up, stripped herself, and laid a burden on 59 other people which they were completely incompetent to pick up or do anything about. So the persona is a very important thing. It also, as in almost everything that Jung identified, it has its negative side. And you'll find in all of Jung's work that he lived and saw everything in terms of the dialectic, the plus and the minus, the yea and the nay. The danger of the persona is that we become identified with it, and we think this thing which we present to the world, allow the world to see, is who we really are inside. I remember, if I wish I had had a paper recorder or gone back to my office and written it down very carefully, but about, it must have been 8 or 10 years ago, I was actually up at the filling station at the corner of, right up here, Shell Station on Clayton Road and whatever that street is, Bellevue. And the clergyman was there. Apparently, I have no idea who he was or what denomination even, but he had apparently just retired. And the filling station attendant was handing him all these accolades about what a great person he was, how much he meant to so many people, and this guy was just taking it all in and swallowing it and identifying with his own persona. He thought he was this figure that he had presented to the world for so many years, and it was in a sense very sad to see. This is incidentally a great danger for him, all of us. It is a particular danger for those in the field of medicine and in the field of the ministry, I feel. We have to present a smart, virtuous, brilliant, highly intelligent front, and we do, and pretty soon we forget that we're kind of dumb. We aren't all things to all men. We aren't Jesus Christ. We're just guys and people in a particular line of work who has his work to do, and we are still very human beneath it all. So this is the persona, and I've identified to a very slight degree both its values and its dangers. Yes. Sure. Good idea. Not as pretty as an idea. So thus far, we've touched upon the basic ingredients of the right-hand half of the circle. There are other elements in there we'll come back to. This is a personal conscious. On the left-hand side of the circle is what he calls the personal unconscious. This contains material which we have experienced and forgotten. Or it has to do with material which we have experienced and directly suppressed or repressed and pushed down because they were materials which are too painful for us to maintain in consciousness. In terms of Freudian psychology, this was essentially what Freud identified as the unconscious or the subconscious. He called it the subconscious. These were all the painful things that he didn't want to remember, and a large part of Freudian analysis is the business of pulling that stuff up by various and sundry methods and means so that we can face that which is in the unconscious. But that area is that dark circle opposite the ego, which is known as the shadow. Around the back side of that circle, there is another series of lines back here. And this is a very important identification. This represented for Jung the contrasexual element in each of us. The contrasexual element in each of us. It says anima, animus. For me, it is an anima, the female side of my psyche, my unconscious. For a female, it is the animus, which is a masculine side of a female. We live in a culture which, by and large, does not admit the reality of the fact that a male can have a female side, or that a female can have a male side to her. It is verboten. This was in my childhood, virtually, for a boy to play with dolls, just as it was more or less verboten for girls to play football. The other side, culturally and by collective standards, is simply not allowed. And yet this is an extremely important part of one's unconscious, and one which gives it one needs very desperately to get in touch. I was reading something the other day, and this is an area where about which I know very little, but it had to do which sort of concerns this. It's a new scientific identification. I wish I'd pointed out it was in some magazine about the fact that, and I've forgotten, at a certain point after the sperm meets the ovum, the physical outcome sexually is determined. That there is a sort of a battle that goes on between the masculine and feminine within the emergence of a new creature, But the thing about this battle is that once one side has, if you will, won, so the fetus becomes either masculine or feminine, does not mean in any way that all the forces and elements, chromosomes, or whatever they are, and I do not know the proper name for them, are not killed. They are still there. They are still part of the fetus, and therefore of the human being after birth. So again, this is a part of the unconscious, which has radical effects upon us. We often do not know, I do not know she's operative within me, and many women do not know the animus is operative within them. Again, as I said, everything has its opposite. And there is a positive anima within me and a negative anima within me. And when my negative anima takes over, as she does on some terrifying occasions, life is torture. She does me good. And when the negative anima takes over in a female, this is also torture and does her good, and she does good to everyone around her. We speak sometimes of animus-driven females, which means that they have no idea what this contrasexual element is, but they act out primarily the negative side of her, of him, and can be very, very difficult people. Now, again, a great deal of the material in the unconscious somehow or other, instead of having it just lie back there and have some effect upon our psyches, all unbeknownst to us, we are likely, it's not a likeliness, it's an inevitability, we project these on outside characters or people or whatever, that so we do not have to deal with them inside. And a lot of fascinating material written on this. Even I have written a paper on the anima and animus and what happens and the way she or he involves us. What happens in normal life is that, I'll tell you what happened to me in my life, I think it's for everybody. At some time or other, I projected my positive anima on a gal out there. Well, as a matter of fact, I projected my positive anima on quite a few gals out there. But in this particular case, it got so caught out there that I finally married the gal. Now, what almost inevitably happens in marriage is that after a year or two or five or sometimes even 10, but it usually starts sooner than that, in my case, it started sooner than that. I began to realize that or think I realized, that Betty was changing. She wasn't the person I married. She seemed to be quite different from what I expected. Well, of course she was, because I didn't marry Betty. I married my projected anima. And a tremendous amount of marital discord emerges because neither the male nor the female in this situation has any idea of what has happened, and that this is normal, and until I can get in touch with my own anima, only then can I let Betty be Betty, accept her for who she is, instead of trying to force her into my projection of what she ought to be. And I think it's only fair to me to say that she had done the same thing to me. She had projected her animus upon me, and for I won't say how many years we tried to straighten each other out. Well, today we got along at this ancient point quite remarkably well. I had better be better, and she lets me be Elton, and this is a rare thing to be accomplished in a marriage, in 15 years or so in the parish ministry, as I worked with those people, after 10 years particularly in a parish in Nashua, New Hampshire, as I was leaving there, I began to look around and think about the people I knew in the parish. I was trying to identify, to see if I could find one, what I would call, good marriage. And there were very few and far between. They put up with each other for a variety of reasons. They had a family, they felt some responsibility with children, and they lived lives of constant irritability and irritation. So the animus is a highly important factor within the unconscious and needs to be taken radical account of. And again, I'm going to suggest at the end of the evening some material if you want to find out more about some of these specific areas which it's just barely touching upon.
What are the characteristics of animus?
What are the characteristics? Well, it's the female side of me inside, in my unconscious. And as I say, they have both positive and negative characteristics. I have both a positive and a negative anima. And it's important. And how to do this is a long story. You can't really get into the night. How do you get in touch with your anima or your animus? I remember I was spending some time with Dr. Esther Harding, who is one of the great young women in New York. She's dead now. And I was talking to her. We learn about these things, strangely enough, often through keeping track of dreams. Where dreams come from? They come from back here. Yeah. Dreams don't come from outside somewhere. They come from our own unconscious. And so I mentioned a dream to her I had about some woman in the dream. And she said, Well, what did you say to her? Oh, I said, oh, we didn't talk. And she would say, well, for God's sake, next time, talk to her. Relate to her. Relate to your dream figures. Write your dreams down. Consider them. Consider the female figures within your dreams. If you're a male. Consider the male figures within your dreams, because often they will be representative of the shadow. And it's the opposite is true of a female. The male figures in your dreams are often animus figures, and the female figures in your dreams are often, not always, you know, they're often, don't advertise any of this. Female figures in a woman's dreams may often be her own shadow. Did I say enough to that?
I'm not really sure on what specifically female characteristics mean, specifically male characteristics.
Well, Jung identified two basic principles as being one being feminine and one being masculine. His term for the masculine principle is Sophia, the head, straightening things out, clarifying. His word for the feminine principle is Eros. Not in terms of erotic, but in terms of the main female characteristic, which is much more likely to be concerned with relationship. The man will say, will argue a point ad nauseum out of his thinking function, whereas the female often will try to relate and help with the fact, so to speak. And there's a lot of fascinating material on this. One thing we use in one of our programs I'll mention later, which is called The Dinner Party. There's a story related by an analyst in New York, about the late Margaret von Franck. But he tells the story of a dinner party, and the people there, in terms of their maleness and their femaleness, and in terms of their psychological types, which we'll come to in a few minutes. It's a beautiful story. You can see yourself and many other people in the nine guests at that dinner party. Okay, in most simplistic terms, the masculine principle is logos, head, the feminine principle is eros, which has to do with related, heard in terms of relationship. Now this doesn't mean that males don't have any relatedness in them, or that females don't have any logos in them, but as a general identification of the two sides, these are the terms we use. Yes.
First of all, when you were mentioning male, you said Sophia.
Sophia.
Now you're talking logos.
I'm sorry, you're right. Logos is a masculine principle. I'm sorry, logos. And eros. I know that Sophia. I've been working with the two terms Sophia and Hochma recently in my head. Not unrelated entirely. Although Sophia is a female figure. Hochma is the Hebrew word for understanding. Sophia is the Greek word, which means more head type knowledge. In some senses, but in other characteristics and symbolisms, it means something different, but that's another part of it. Okay. Now the most difficult thing for me, I had difficulty, as I first began to get involved in this, I said, you know, some of the things I'd heard about Jung were quite exciting. It was perfectly apparent that although, because of his concern for this drive for meaning and wholeness, that he had far more respect for the religious enterprise than either Freud or Adler. But then as I got a little bit farther along, a lot of stuff came along that would have thought was sort of weird, and I'm sure you will if you're as normal as I think I am. First of all, I thought dreams mean, you know, so what? They don't mean anything. And I was talking with a guy named Bill Kennedy in New York, who was president of the Jung Foundation there one day about this. This was years back, of course. And I said, dreams don't mean anything to me at all. In fact, I hardly ever dream. And, well, of course, I hadn't read the latest articles on dreams in various magazines for the last 5 years. That we have a tremendous amount of time we are sort of asleep, we are dreaming. The point is we don't catch them. And he said, well, can you remember any dream? And I said, yeah, 3 or 4 months ago I had a dream, and it was just pure nonsense. And I told him this dream. And he said, pure nonsense, huh? And an hour and a half later, I practically took myself off the floor, as he had been identifying no personal stuff in this dream, but material from way back here in the collective unconscious, which was the thing which made absolutely no sense to me to begin with. It took me some time, even after this session with Bill, to buy into this. Because I think I'd always assumed, as I think most of us assume, that when we are born, our psyche is a tabula rasa, an erased slate. There's nothing there. And it took some time before I began to recognize and was willing to admit the possibility of the so-called collective unconscious that lies back there. Now I'm thoroughly convinced, after this amount of work and time with it, that it is a very important, extremely important part of the psyche, the most mysterious of all, the hardest to get to, but it contains all kinds of things. The figures back in the collective unconscious are images that Dr. Jung called archetypes. Now, the collective unconscious is something with which we are born. Something with which we are born. It is the accumulated symbolism, imagery, archetypal structures of the race. He first called this the race of unconscious. He was actually speaking of the human race. But then there came a time in the 30s and 40s when race became a big thing because of what was going on in Germany. So then he changed the term to collective unconscious. then we began to have some trouble with Russia. And so the final term for this area back here is the objective psyche. All these three terms mean the same. Most of us still use the term collective unconscious because it had not been changed when we first got involved with. These are images, factors, figures that Jung found identifiable in all cultures and all races. They differ to some degree, and this is almost impossible to diagram because there are thousands of archetypes back there. Nobody's even ever tried to quote count them because they're unclassifiable. Except there are certain ones that are very standard. And just a few of them we've identified here. There's an archetype of mother, father, sister, and so forth and so on. And once again, each of these figures, archetypically, in the archetypal form, has both its negative and positive aspects. It takes the great mother, Eric Neumann, the great analyst in Tel Aviv, has written a brilliant, large book on the mother archetype called The Great Mother. Now, mother, I don't know whether how you feel about your own mother, but in your mother archetype, you have two sides. She has two sides. One is the nourishing mother, one who provides for, who takes care of, who helps, who rocks me to sleep, and does all that kind of thing. But there's also the other side known as the devouring mother. She is the one who overpowers me, who wants to keep me in complete control, and if she has the chance, as it would come out in normal life, keep me tied to her apron strings as long as she lives. Same is true of father, brother, sister, always. The archetypes of gods and goddesses, you notice here, also there is the archetype of God, the single God, and of its opposite below. Male and female animals, both friendly and hostile. These are figures that appear in dreams. All these figures appear in dreams, and many more. And at the very back of this particular diagram, there is the archetype of Christ. Now, I've never been able to figure out how to diagram this. So I'll admit at the beginning that this is an incomplete diagram. I don't know how to do it. But this is the, as man in the, this little half circle here represents primitive man. And I don't know, I'm not an anthropologist, I don't know, you know, whether they saw this one or two or where, or in Africa or wherever. But anyway, man began to spread out around the world. So we've got the Orient, we've got Europe, we've got various other radical divisions. The American Indian, the whole African culture. And these, for many years, were completely shut off from each other. Yet, Jung, as you remember, may have remembered in the movie, in studying this whole area of archetypes, went all over the world and studied the dreams and so forth of the American Indian. He worked with the Navajos here in this country. He went to Africa, he studied the work being done in India and China and Japan. And he found certain things that were completely common in the archetypical or collective unconscious structure of all men all over the world. For instance, he found that there were four basic symbols of wholeness which were common to all cultures. These symbols are the circle, the square, the sphere, and the fraternity. I do not want to get into any kind of theological argument, and he wasn't trying to get into any kind of theological argument, and I can't deny it, you're taking what I'm saying now. But one, remember that the doctrine of the Trinity emerged and was finalized at the end of the 4th century, I think. It emerged before that, but Notice that, as Jung identified, the Trinity is incomplete. It is not a symbol of wholeness because there's one person missing. As Jung identified in some of his writing on psychology and religion, somehow the psyche of man could not quite stand for that. And by the 5th century in Italy, this fourth person began to emerge. The fourth person, of course, was Mary. Mary began very early in Italy to be an object of the way to get at Jesus, as a mediatrix to him. Mary has grown in Roman Catholic theology constantly through the years. Again, Jung is not arguing for Mary as the fourth person of the Trinity, in no way. What he is saying is that it's the unconscious of man that has raised her and elevated her through all the things through what she's moved through the years in Roman Catholic theology. I forget, it was just in the last century that she was assumption, doctrine of the assumption, and later on the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception. It has nothing to do with birth. It has to do with Mary herself was conceived without intercourse between male and female. She has even been talked about occasionally in more recent Roman Catholic theology as co-redemptrix. Now again, I'm not arguing for a fraternity. I'm saying that somehow or other the psyche of man needed a fourth part of this thing to fill it out, and that it may be that the rational mind of second, third, and fourth century theologians were not able to comprehend the need for this. I hope this whole type, personally, of doctrinal dispute dies. There is the Almighty, there is the God. Fighting about, well, you know what happened in the second, third, fourth century. The church almost tore itself apart, trying to decide metaphysical questions which it had no competence to decide. The whole homoousia battle that almost tore the church to pieces. Whether Christ was of the same nature or similar nature to God the Father. This is beyond the necessity for man, I think, as far as I'm concerned, to try to identify. So I'm not fighting for a four-person Trinity. I'm not fighting for Mary. But the other thing that she does add, remember that the doctrine of the Trinity was enunciated by a bunch of men, and the feminine is lacking in the Godhead. And without the female, without the feminine side, there is an incompleteness in the Trinitarian doctrine. I'm still a Trinitarian. I'm also a Unitarian. I have a feeling toward fraternity. I don't know what I'd call it. We're talking now really about psychology using a theological reference. Now, at the very back of this particular diagram of the collective unconscious is the Christ. Now again, as I started to say here, as man moves out, we all possess certain basic archetypes in the collective unconscious which are extremely primitive and go back all the way back to the very primitive man. But also, the collective unconscious is something that through the centuries grows. And while they have many common factors and many similarities of images,
each culture begins to develop certain aspects of its own collective unconscious which are different from any others. And for Western man, Christ for him is a symbol of the self. Now I haven't identified the central factor in the psyche. Self, as opposed to ego, Jung used as the symbol of wholeness. This is an identification of the man I would be or become if I lived into my wholeness.
To the degree that I live in, you know, Jesus said, I'm come that men may have life and have it more abundantly. I'm not sure I want any more abundantly. I got about as much I can take now. But the New English Bible translates it, I've come that men may have life and have it in all its fullness. Yeah, that I think I do want. I like that translation better. I think it means more what he was talking about. Fullness of life is to move more and more toward my own full potential, which is identified symbolically in the essential identification of the self, which is usually in manner of psychology spelt with a capital S. The Western man, Christ, has always been the symbol of wholeness, the symbol of moving into fullness of life. Now, he's often distorted in many ways. Goodness only knows. But somehow or other, I suspect that the whole Jesus Freak movement, as distorted as at least I think that is in so many ways, may be a scene from the unconscious to take some account of this archetypal figure who has been either misrepresented or not represented at least adequately enough through institutional churches. You know, the imitatio Christi, the imitation of Christ, is not a matter of doing the things that he did, following along the pattern of his life and behavior. I am not competent to do this. But the true imitatio is that I live into my life as fully as Christ lived into his. That I live into my calling as fully as he lived into his. This is the true imitatio. And this is that which this archetype is calling for and trying to get in touch with the center of me and increasingly, hopefully during life, as one matures, the ego gets into closer and closer contact with this center of the whole business. Well, I've covered most of the material in this diagram, I admit, very briefly. But all I can do tonight, again, there are 20 volumes in Jung's collected work, and another 400 volumes of material written by his followers. So that I'm just touching very briefly on some highlights. And if you want to follow this up, any particular areas. We can certainly identify where you can find some further material. As Lawrence van der Post identified the other day, Jung brought new words virtually into the English language that people are virtually unaware of. At least he gave them time and meaning. One of them is that of extrovert and introvert. These are what he calls the two basic attitudes. This I do not have a diagram of, but it's very simple if you want to put this down. The people are, each individual is a particular individual, and his normal attitude toward life is either extroverted or introverted or somewhere along the continuum between the two extremes. Two children will walk down the street and there will be a quote haunted house. The extrovert wants to go and see what's in there. He's concerned with these things out there. The introvert's much more concerned about what might happen to him in there. And I don't mean that introverts are more fearful than extroverts. Extroverts are fearful too, but maybe he's... But along with the two basic attitudes, Jung identified what he called four functions. Now, from time immemorial, it has been identified that people are different. They're not all the same. They act in different ways to the same phenomenon. I forget, was it Socrates or somebody who set up a very early set of types. I can never remember them all, but they're phlegmatic, choleric, sanguine, and one other. An early philosopher.
But these represent what he calls the four functions. This function is he calls sensation.
These words I use technically here, it doesn't mean sensational, it means that which I absorb through the senses. As I walk over here, my sense of touch tells me there's something there. My sense of sight tells me there are 20 people in the room. My hearing can hear your question. I may not be able to answer it, but I can hear it.
So this is the function of the senses. This is the thinking function.
The thinking function is that which classifies things. It tells me that this is a podium, this is a microphone, so forth, that's a chair.
The third function over here is called intuition.
It is the intuitive function that shows the possibility of something. In other words, I can use this as a podium to speak from. I might be able to also pull over there and climb up on it and change the light and the fixture if it went out. I also lay it down on its back and use it as a sort of a box to put stuff into. This is what the intuitive function does. Sees the possibilities in a given situation or in a given object.
The fourth function is that of feeling,
which is not to be, again, the way he uses the term, it's not to be confused with emotion, but rather valuing. How do I feel about the way this meeting is going? How do I evaluate the people who are here? How do I evaluate analytical psychology? So this is a feeling function. And how do I evaluate people with whom I'm related in some way or other? Now, the problem here is that each of us is born, and no one yet has identified why this is so, with one of these functions as primary. Question?
I'd like to ask the question on
the first
question.
Yes.
Does he provide for a change within a person that changes from introverted type attitude to extroverted?
Good question. If I'm born an extrovert, I will remain an extrovert as long as I live, which does not mean, however, again, in terms of opposites, that I cannot more and more get in touch with my introverted attitude and use it when it's appropriate. So as again, this has, as we'll see as I finish this, that the movement toward wholeness is to be able to be introverted when it's appropriate and to be extroverted when it's appropriate, but my essential attitude is going to remain extroverted.
What do you mean by
that? Like, people tell me that they're extroverted,
one has more than one extroverted person that makes you more extroverted than
extroverted. Did you say cylinders?
Yeah, well,
yeah. This is the mystery of the psyche. And the psyche is a mystery which we are just in this century beginning to touch on and begin to identify some of the factors and forces within it. What makes a person introverted or extroverted, no one has yet identified, and maybe never will. Maybe that mystery. Yes, it is something that not necessary. Now, you're raising questions which I want to come back to. Yeah, no, so the question is right, and one I want to which I want to speak. And I'll speak to it right away. Each person has one of these four functions, which is his primary or predominant function. It's the way he normally moves into a situation via one or the other of these. Now, Western culture has placed a high value on the introverted or extroverted thinking type, while I would say Oriental culture has placed a high value, perhaps certainly on introversion. I'm not sure which fits the four functions. So that in the whole educational process and the whole living in a culture which rewards the extroverted thinking type, our kids in school are pulled toward that. This may result in what Jung identified as a falsification of type, and in some cases led to serious neurosis, if not psychosis. Now, this is not to say that if I'm an extrovert, I shouldn't try to get in touch with my introverted side. But if it's too radical, a drive from the collective world in which I find myself, it can be serious. And I think our whole education, this raises wild questions with the whole educational process, because there are so many different types, as we'll see in a moment, that no one way of procedure is going to hit each of the different types. Let me finish the function for a minute.
Let's assume for a moment that I'm afraid
to assume. Let me tell you this also. There is no advantage in being one type or over against another. There is no value judgment in this at all. It's just that this is the way we are.
Let's assume that I am a sentient. This is my primary function is intuition. I probably have some touch with
at least one
and possibly two of the adjacent functions. Always, as this is diagrammed here, the object will be my inferior function. This is the one at which I am poorest.
This is the one that I may have to spend some time with myself about and try to get it operative when it's appropriate to have it operative. To the extent that while I will never move, if I'm an intuitive, I will never become a sensation type. Sensation is a function which has its own value, which has its own importance, which has its own place. And because I have little touch with it, and this happens to be true of me, I'm quite incomplete. And it causes me much trouble. I have a great deal of trouble with seeing people and remembering names, and that's not good in my profession. I remember one time about 10 years ago, we were doing a conference out in Albuquerque. One of my associates and I were working together, and now, 3 weeks later, he said, remember that gal across the hall or the table from us? I said, what gal? He said, well, she had on blue earrings with black crisscross lines. Well, see, I'm not, his primary function is sensation. And he picked up all of it. He said, you know, she had beautiful legs. I didn't even notice that, you know.
All right.
So that a person might be said, for instance, to be an extroverted, intuitive thinking type, which probably means that he needs to do some work on these two other functions. This is the way he normally approaches life. He needs to find out more about what these things are, what they mean. There are tests, and no test is final or complete or ultimate or absolute. But there are tests. We use one in one of our operations called the Graves-Wheelwright test, where you can answer a whole series of questions, which begins to give you some clue as to where you fit in this typological structure. Let me just say one more thing, and then hold it. So let's assume that each of us has two functions going, and is either extrovert or introvert. Okay, I'm either a thinking intuitive or intuitive thinking, one of them predominates. And if you go around the horn doing each of these this way, you come up with eight possibilities. But because you also have to add this in a typological structure, and all this, you end up with at least 16 basic types of people to begin with all the variations that are also contained therein, because there are people who live almost entirely in one country, have no touch of the other with another side, and there are also those who have a some touch of two sides, so the variations are infinite. No, value judgments are down here in feelings, just the opposite of thinking. Now that doesn't mean to say that thinking type doesn't make value judgments. We all make value judgments. This has to do with how you approach most situations. Now this is slightly related to that logos eros thing I was talking about a while ago. The thinking logos male will fight to the very last ditch to make sure the facts are straight and that something is perfectly understood and that his point of view is correct and so forth and so on, and kill people in the process. While a feeling type and an eros type female, for instance, will think the value does not lie in figuring out the last decimal point in a mathematical equation, if it's going to ruin the party and break up a relationship. A very quick attempt to identify this. No. Sensation, I would say that it's a thing, function that processes the data. The sensation function brings it in. Thinking classifies it. A person with a photographic memory would undoubtedly be a sensation type. Now, he might be able to get a very high mark on an examination, which would seem like a thinking function, but he can read a page and grasp it and remember it. By what? And putting it out again, the sensation type could certainly do that. He might not necessarily understand what it meant.
Right. So my point in asking the two questions is I see that there were similarities between transactional analysis and the feeling side of the adult sensation and the thinking parent. I don't know what to do with intuition, but
I've not tried to fit into this particular pattern, so I can't answer the question. I think TA has some relationship to all the stuff back here. I think it's been very helpful to a great many people. Now, I would not denigrate it for a minute, but I know it has. I'm not an expert in it. I think this goes an awful lot farther than Ben's work and has his work. Well, your knot is coming probably from this function because there's a value judgment going on. I don't like it and I can't stand it, and it does. I said this is not the same as emotion. It often produces emotional affect. Yes.
I think that I really spoke of
I think this sounds similar, although I never happened to read where he spoke of it as four brains. He may have somewhere in some of these I've missed.
I think it's in
alchemical studies. That I have not read. We have it. I have not read. Right. But I think it's sort of saying the same thing about the four functions. Well, this has gone on enough, I hope, to give you some little inkling of and just a little inkling. I have some other material that you may have if you'd like it. This is a very brief outline of analytical psychology written by Dr. Edward Edinger in New York the concepts that we've been speaking of tonight and perhaps more clearly than I've been able to clarify them. You already have that, I think. If you're interested in any further reading, I'd like to, I've got a book list here that you may have. But I'd like to speak of a certain number of them in particular. Well, why don't we pass these out, because I can speak to them better if you can see them. Turn to the yellow sheet, the second sheet. The first is a fairly long list, a page and a half. The second sheet is some of the ones that we think are more important and more useful to begin with, much against our will, because a lot of this material is not available in all bookstores. We have finally have a, quote, bookstore up at the center. So all these things are available there at 10% discount. We're not trying to sell books. This is not our work, but we've had to. If you want to check my basic initial recommendations, I would start with one right about in the middle called Introduction to Jung Psychology by Frieda Fordham. It's $1.25 paperback. Dr. Fordham and her husband are both analysts in London, and Frieda wrote this for her 17-year-old daughter, so she understands what they're in business about. So it's, I don't mean it's written at a juvenile level, but it's not overly technical, though the terms are identified. The first title, Analytical Psychology, is Theory and Practice. Is a transcript of a series of lectures Jung gave, the so-called Tavistock lectures in England. It includes questions and answers and back and forth, and it's simpler to read than some of his writing, and it also reveals his great, beautiful sense of humor. Boundaries of the Soul, The Power of Cost $10, has just come out, written by June Singer, an analyst in Chicago. It's a tremendous book. It's one of the best that's been put out on the whole story. The Inner World of Childhood, Francis Witt, is a very important book, particularly for educators. But it doesn't just speak of children, it goes through the whole bit, the whole basic understandings of Jung. James Hillman's Insert, I would check. Man and His Symbols is a beautiful book. You notice, if you saw the movie, you saw part of the interview with John Freeman with Jung. Back in about 1959, I think it was done. It was broadcast over the BBC, it had a radical effect on an awful lot of people in England. Just that interview on television, and a lot of people who had never heard of Jung began to get interested, and Finally, a publisher in England asked him to go back to Jung to ask him if he would help in the preparation or write a book for the laity. Jung said no. And that he worked with analysts, people who were in training, and that he did not feel that this was yet ready for the world, for the layman. And that night he had a dream in which he was standing on a mountain and looked out and heard a whole crowd of people who were not only listening to him but understanding what he was saying. And he called to him the next day and said, "I changed my mind." The result of that was that the head of the British Museum, Annalisa Jaffe, who you saw in the movie, if you saw it, Dr. Henderson, San Francisco, Jung, and a fourth writer, I've forgotten now who, put together a book, which is this book called Man and His Symbols. It's a beautiful book. It came out, I think it was $18, and they finally got a $6.95 edition of it, which is fully illustrated with the most beautiful colored pictures of mandalas and the circles and the squares and all kinds of things. It's a fantastic book. Memories, dreams, and reflections, just to identify it, I would not certainly start with. This was, in a sense, Jung's own autobiography. Not so much in terms of what he did, but in terms of his own inner journey. The Way of All Women, I hope this is coming out soon in paperback, is one of the most significant books, and it tells as much about men as it does about women on the whole area of anima, animus, and all that is involved in that. Now, those are just some suggestions if you want to go into some of those particular areas. And I can hardly end without talking about something that we at the Center are very excited about. Summer before last, I was driving home from vacation with Mrs. Brown, Kent Brown, who's on our staff, and we've been very much involved with Jung together through the years. And we began talking about how, and we've been talking for 10 years about how unfortunate it was that many of Jung's understandings were virtually denied so many people, unless they read the book, unless they were in analysis. Now, Jungian analysts are very few and far between, and somehow or other, unfortunately, they sort of collect. You know, you go to New York, and you go to the Jung Institute of New York, and you get trained, and then you do your year of analysis under supervision, by which time you've got a practice form, so why leave New York? So that we have a whole bunch of them in New York. Only in the last year, 2 years, have we had any in Boston, one in Richmond, Virginia, a lot in San Francisco and California, one in Seattle, two now in Chicago, none in St. Louis, except for Dr. Gilday, who's been, had some training, but not a fully equipped Jungian analyst here in the city, who was here at the movie the night, and Margaret Gilday, and she's married to a radical Freudian, who's also an analyst. But both Dr. Gilday and both Dr. Gilday's 5 years ago, I mentioned Dr. Harding and The Way of All Women. We've been very close to her for a good many years. She's done conferences for the Educational Center. And she had her 80th birthday. She summers in Maine, and up at Brunswick, Maine, they had a European-type celebration of her 80th birthday. It lasted 4 days and consisted of I think 12 papers being read by doctors from all over the world, from Zurich, from London, from San Francisco, from New York. And it was a fascinating 4 days. And as I say, Dr. Gilday and his, both Dr. Gilday were at that, where we met them at this the first time. So as I say, to return to my story about a trip across country, Miss Kent Brown. The more we talk about this, the more we felt that there should be some ways where people who have been caught in a lot of our adult courses that do touch on young hither, thither, and yon, and who wanted more of an intensive way to go on and continue, we developed in that conversation and has subsequently produced an entire different kind of, we don't even know what to call it, a course, but it's entitled Center Point. the way this works, it's an unusual type thing. A small group of people, we hope roughly between 6 and 8, who want to pursue this in some depth, agree to meet for 18 sessions that run 2 to 2.5 hours each. They are provided from the center with a cassette on which certain material is placed. In the first year, we deal very much with the ego, with the persona, with the shadow. Certain areas are dealt with in the first year. The collective unconscious is touched upon. And this will go on. There'll be another. Last, a year ago, January, we started this out here in St. Louis for the first time with a sort of a trial balloon type thing. There were 21 people involved, divided into 3 coteries of 7 people each. We had 7 pilot sessions with them, and if you can figure out the mathematics, if my mathematics are right, we got 21 people meeting together for 10 sessions, which makes 210 possible attendances. There are only 202. 5 of those were center staff who could not be present because we were traveling. Now these were people, some of whom had already been involved with Jung, most of them had never, had virtually knew the name, but that was about all. So we started this as a full-scale program across the country in September. There are now, we're pushing 75 coteries going. Well, I think there are 8 in Houston, there are several in San Francisco, 3 or 4 in this area. It's been a very exciting operation. What happens in the thing is that you have to have a cassette tape recorder, okay? There is no leader as such. Each session, a different person is a so-called presenter with a little instruction sheet about what to do. Well, the instruction sheet mainly says, press the start button on the cassette recorder and listen to a certain section of the content produced there, and then a bell rings and you stop it. And you discuss what you've heard for the last 8 or 10 minutes, however long, and and some possible discussion questions are given on the presenter sheet if they're needed, which mostly they're not. then you go on and listen to another 8 or 10 minutes, and maybe the actual material in each session, the early sessions are fairly long, about 45 minutes, but most of them are much shorter than that. Not over 30 minutes of actual input on the tape. You also get with that a transcript. And then there's a transcript of the material, and there are other parts of it. I don't know if anyone's interested or not. So I'd like to go back to where we got the name. Dr. Harding, whom I spoke of a few minutes ago, is the author of The Way of All Women and a number of other books as well, did a conference for us. He was 80 years old, and now it's the first of our annual conferences. We have 4 or 5 across the country in May and June every year. the topic was the cross as an archetypal symbol. At the age of 80, we flew out to our first conference in Las Vegas, Helena Sahara Hotel. And it's interesting walking Dr. Harding through the game room. In the series, the cross is archetypal symbol. Dr. Harding spoke of one's being impaled on the cross, so to speak, by the terrible conflict of the opposites. The opposite symbolized by the arms of the cross. But he pointed out that while the opposites repel, they also attract each other. And even in the midst of the conflict, the opposites are still held together by the tiny point, the minuscule dot that is at the center of the crossing. He went on to say, quote, "This is the point that stands firm in spite of the conflict, the essential I, capital I, and cannot bear to choose one side and neglect the opposite on pain of dismemberment. It is that individual coreness that cannot resolve a moral problem by merely conventional standards. It is that weak yet strong coreness that will not be swayed merely by the multitude. But in order to find this central core of selfness, capital S, one has to undertake the arduous and dangerous responsibility of thinking for oneself. It is not so important if what you think to be eternally right, provided the thought is really true for one's being as it is at that moment. The fact is, you make yourself by thinking, by taking up a position based not only on thought, but on feeling as well. It is consciousness of importance, not thinking as such. By becoming aware of what is your own judgment, based on the totality of what you experience of yourself, you take up a position. The point has position. It is the essence of position. It is a standpoint. And the point or dot is the first symbol of the self. It is to the discovery of this tiny point at the center of one's being, one's own standpoint, the center point will be dedicated in hope that it has taken its name. I guess I've kept you long enough. Thank you very much.
If anybody wants to have a cup of coffee at Rehoboam's Talking Formula, you're welcome to.
I'll get one too.